This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Anti-government extremists feed on conspiracy theories. One of the books that's been circulating within the militia movement as evidence of government conspiracies is really a hoax. It's a satire created by a group of liberal writers. Here's the story. In 1966, Victor Nevasky, now the longtime editor of The Nation, and a couple of his colleagues decided to do a satiric book that would point out the absurdity of the popular idea that war is good for the economy and peace is bad. They came up with a comic premise. Suppose the government had appointed a task force to plan the transition out of a wartime economy, and the task force concluded that peace would ruin the economy. The government thought this conclusion might look bad, so the report was kept secret. Well, satirist Leonard Lewin took on the job of writing this phony report. Lewin's report concluded that if peace should break out, we'd need to find substitutes for war, such as an omnipresent international police force, new enemies, including a fictitious extraterrestrial menace, and a modern form of slavery to maintain the class system. Lewin's book, published under the title Report from Iron Mountain, didn't identify itself as satire. Now, almost 30 years later, it's been republished. I asked Victor Nevasky what gave him the idea for the book.
The idea for Report from Iron Mountain came to me one day when I saw a little headline in the newspaper saying that the stock market had fallen abruptly because of a peace scare. And we got an idea, and we were in the sort of book packaging business, and we got an idea to do a book about the quashing of a report which was commissioned by the White House to plan the transition from a wartime to a peacetime economy. And we would do a kind of hoax book about what happened when the commission concluded that the economy would collapse if peace really broke out. And that's where Report from Iron Mountain, the original idea, came from, a little shirt tale in a newspaper story.
So you had this idea to do a satire. Then you hired a satirist, Leonard Lewin. What were some of the embellishments he added to your idea?
Well, Leonard took the position that he couldn't write the story of a report that was suppressed until he read the report that was suppressed. And so first he had to write this report that was going to be suppressed. And we then embarked on this very ambitious effort to gather together materials from people ranging from folks working at the Institute for Policy Studies like Arthur Waskow, John Kenneth Galbraith at Harvard, and other people who had really studied the issue of transition from war to peace. And we had an intern who gathered together all the reports of the Rand and Hudson Institutes, etc. And meanwhile, we had to find a publisher, and we were lucky in having a relationship with Dial Press, which had an editor-in-chief, then unknown to the great public, E.L. Doctorow, who, of course, went on to write Book of Daniel and Ragtime and his many other books, which take inspiration from the world of fact, but are premised on the idea that truth is better arrived at frequently through fiction. And Edgar and his publisher, Richard Barron, both saw that by doing this as a hoax, presenting it as if it were a real report, that would be a way of bringing attention to the issue that could be quite powerful if we could pull it off.
How are you and Leonard Lewin hoping that this satire would be interpreted? What were you intending to satirize?
I think that we both, the way he wrote it, that we both were intending to satirize both the style of think tank thinking. And this was during the period when operations like the Rand Corporation and the Hudson Institute and their proprietors like Herman Kahn were writing books with titles like Thinking About the Unthinkable, and they were playing war games. The first, I think, thing that Leonard was interested in satirizing was that these people were being taken seriously and were being paid millions of dollars to plan our national policy in the defense area. And secondly, I think his purpose, and I guess ours were, to say that society ought to be paying attention to how you move to convert from a wartime to a peacetime economy and to devote the same energy and resources to that that we're devoting to maintaining what Leonard called the war system.
Now, did you market this book as a satire or as an expose of a real document?
Dial Press listed the book as nonfiction, and it was marketed on the assumption that people would, if it worked, debate whether it was real or not, and that would force a debate on whether we really were, did have our priorities inverted, and whether we really were operating on a system which was premised on the threat of war rather than a system that was seeking a peace with serious resources devoted to it.
So you were marketing this as nonfiction. Did people get the fact that it was a hoax? That it was a satire?
Well, I think the first thing that happened was that a reporter for the New York Times, John Leo, who now writes a column for U.S. News and World Report, called Dial Press when he saw it in their catalog and maybe read something about it, and or maybe saw Esquire magazine, which printed a big chunk of it as if it were a real government report, and asked them whether it was fiction or nonfiction. And they referred him to the footnotes in the report. Now, all the footnotes in this report are to real documents and articles in pseudoscientific, in scientific, political science journals, etc. And he then called the White House, and of course it was the Johnson White House by that time, and they, instead of giving a flat denial, said they would have to check into it, but don't quote them. And he then called the State Department, and by the time he got finished, he wrote a story, the first paragraph of which said that this possible hoax was a possible real document. No one would confirm, it was insufficiently confirmed or denied. And that got on the front page of the New York Times. And that led to a round of speculation as to whether it was real or not. And then everyone was off to the races. And at some point, Galbraith, who John Kenneth Galbraith, who had been in on the thing from the beginning and who reviewed the report under one of his pseudonyms, Dr. Herschel McLandris, was accused of having written it, and he called a press conference and said it only could have been written by one of two people if it wasn't real, and that was Dean Rusk or Claire Booth Luce. And that that then got the thing on the bestseller list, and it was, for a year, debated whether it was real or not.
What do you think that extremists and people in militias read in the report from Iron Mountain that fits into their worldview and that feeds certain conspiracy theories that they have?
Well, I think the basic premise that this is a government document which the government suppressed because it contained information that the government believed the people were not fit to hear and incapable of dealing with is a precise paradigm for their worldview that our government lies and does this all the time. And so even though it dealt with a report that that had an alleged conclusion that they might not like, the fact that it purports to be a report that the government has suppressed and lied about the suppression of fits right into their paranoid worldview.
How did you find out that Report from Iron Mountain had actually become one of the more popular books read by extremists?
Well, in three different ways. Number one is the Wall Street Journal ran a front page story saying that after the Oklahoma bombings. Number two, The Nation sponsored an evening at Town Hall on the movie JFK and whether filmmakers have some obligation to history, and Oliver Stone was there, and Norman Mailer was there, and Edward J. Epstein, who had written a number of books on the assassination, were on the panel, and someone in the audience objected that Oliver Stone had used as one of his consultants on the film a man named Fletcher Prouty, who was the model for the Donald Sutherland character in the film. And they objected on the grounds that Prouty was a member of the extremist and anti-Semitic liberty lobby. And Stone's response was that he used Prouty not as because of his private politics, but because he was a consultant to the National Security Council at the time. And subsequently, Ed Epstein was asked to write up the evening for a new collection of his assassination writings as an introduction, which appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. And in going through the transcript, he he got a copy of Fletcher Prouty's forthcoming memoirs and noticed that he cited report from Iron Mountain as if it were a real report, and called him to say, you know, wasn't this a hoax or a satire? And Prouty said he knew that it was real because he knew some people who were there or something like that. So that was the second indication I had of it. And then the third was that it turned out Leonard, whom I had not been in touch with for a while, had been in, I called him and to tell him about all this, and then he told me that he had been in litigation with the Liberty Lobby because they were so persuaded that the report was the real thing that that they didn't bother to get copyright permission to reprint it, and had reprinted it as if it were a government document and were selling it. And he went to court and won a settlement, and as a result, they stopped publishing it.
Part of what you like so much about Report from Iron Mountain is the language and tortured thinking, and how similar it was to the think tank thinking of the time and to the government reports of the time, or perhaps of today as well. Could you read for us one of your favorite passages in the book that illustrates that language and thinking?
Well, sure, but I'll open at random rather than read a favorite passage because they're all over the place. So I'm now going to open to page 100, and under the general conclusions, he is now talking about the fact that there is no program or general program for peace. And he'll say, until such a unified program is developed, at least hypothetically, it's impossible for this or any other group, he's talking about the special group that did the study, to furnish meaningful answers to the question originally presented to us. When asked how best to prepare for the advent of peace, we must first reply as strongly as we can that the war system cannot responsibly be allowed to disappear until, one, we know exactly what it is we plan to put in its place, and, two, we are certain beyond reasonable doubt that these substitute institutions will serve their purposes in terms of the survival and stability of society. It will then be time enough to develop methods for effectuating the transition. Procedural programming must follow, not precede, substantive solutions. Now that last sentence is
great.
It runs right by you because procedural programming must follow, not precede, substantive solutions. How can you say no?
You know what I was thinking about when I was reading Report from Iron Mountain? I mean, this is a your book is a parody of how people were afraid that if we had an enduring peace, it would be bad for the economy.
Right.
And we've all been reading in the newspaper lately that because employment is up and unemployment is down, that the stock market is going berserk, and people are terrified about the economy because more people have jobs.
Right. No.
Similar irony to you?
Absolutely. When I woke up one morning and read that the stock market had taken a dive because of these good employment statistics, the first thing I thought of was Report from Iron Mountain, and this quote Leonard has in it. This is a direct quote taken from the old Herald Tribune, quote, Wall Street was shaken yesterday by news of an apparent peace feeler from North Vietnam, but swiftly recovered its composure after about an hour of sometimes indiscriminate selling. Imagine that.
Victor Novesky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Victor Novesky is the editor of The Nation. The satire he collaborated on, Report from Iron Mountain, has just been republished by the Free Press. This is Fresh Air.